This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Last night I introduced a theme which I'm going to talk about in Yitzhak Hashem this evening and possibly next week as well. And that is the theme of growth in suffering. And a lot of what I'm going to say is based on a wonderful piece of work done on the subject by Rabbi Avrom Grudzinski. We noted last night that Rashi asked why the staffs of the tribes which flowered in the Mishkan, or the staff which flowered, the staff of Aaron flowered, why the blossoms were almond blossoms and not any other particular blossom. And Rashi answered, V'lam shkedim, why almonds? Hu ha'pri ha'mamahil ha'friach mikol ha'piris. Because almond blossoms are the first blossoms to come out. They come the quickest. The first after winter is the almond. Likewise, one who questions the sanctity and uniqueness of the Kohanim, the Kohuno, his punishment will be very quick. The Ribbono Shel Olam will not wait, but immediately there will be a response. That's why the almonds, to remind us that the Ribbono Shel Olam's reaction to this particular chet is very, very quick. Rashi goes on to say, "Kemoshe matzinu beUzio," as we find with Uzio. Uzio was a king; he was a good king until he started getting a little arrogant, and he wanted to bring the Ketores. He wanted to do the job that the Kohanim were doing up till then. And the Tanakh tells us, "V'hatzorah zorcho beMitzchoi," when he wanted to do that, and the form that the Tzoras took there, Rashi says, was like kind of shkedim, like almond blossoms, also to remind him that there's no waiting on this. When it comes to this area of trying to take the place of the Kohanim, the Ribbono Shel Olam reacts very quickly. And we asked last night that that's a strange image. That means that Rashi is learning that the image of the blossoming of the staffs is an image of puronus, of punishment. And to use a blossom to portray the image of puronus, of suffering and punishment, sounds odd. And that leads us into our understanding of puronus, of the fact that suffering can be seen not as the consequences of something that has been, or not only as the consequences of something that has been, and thus as the end, the final episode of an unpleasant past. Sometimes I want to think, I did wrong, and now I've suffered, and it's over, and I'm ready to start again. It is possible to view suffering rather as the beginning of a new period, of a new phase in one's life. Just as the blossom is not seen as the final stage of winter, but rather as the opening stages of the spring, the almond blossom, so it is possible to see suffering not as the final stages of the winter, but as the opening stages of the blossoming of the spring. And that really is what we're going to be discussing. How is it possible to see suffering as a blossom, as something optimistic, as something which is leading to a bright future rather than indicative of a negative past? Viktor Frankl did a lot of work on suffering when he was in the concentration camps. And perhaps the most important observation of all was his observation that different people responded differently to the same suffering. But suffering cannot be measured in objective quantities, and one cannot predict how people are going to handle suffering. The suffering of the camps, he said, brought out the lowest in people, and in other people it brought out the greatest. It produced tzaddikim and it produced rishoyim. There were people who, because of the suffering, became mean and embittered and cruel and subhuman. And there were people who were in the same state of suffering who became giving and righteous and saintly. And therefore he concluded, and on the basis of that conclusion he built his entire system of psychology which is used worldwide today. But it is not the objective circumstance which determines the effect on the human being, but rather the way the human being handles that circumstance. It's all inside the person. A person can handle an enormous amount if he handles it right. And we find that. We find that some people have low tolerances of suffering and some people have high tolerances of suffering. Some people can handle pain, some people can't. Some people, I don't want to use the word thrive, because none of us are meant to thrive on suffering. We're not looking at some kind of masochistic desire for pain and suffering, that's for sure. And yet some people grow in suffering and grow in pain and can handle it, and some don't. And the essence of it, as Viktor Frankl notes, is seeing some purpose to it. One can sit in the dentist's chair and one can survive the pain because one sees the purpose. One is being healed. He's fixing one, and one is suffering the pain in order not to suffer worse consequences later on. So people can, some people can sit in the dentist's chair and handle the pain. And yet that same pain, or a lesser pain, if it were inflicted just for the fun of it, if the dentist said, look, there's nothing wrong with your teeth, they're absolutely fine, but I'm sure you don't want to feel done out of your money. After all, you have paid to come and see me today, so how about let's doing a little drilling close to one of the nerves, just for fun. Don't worry, I'll fill it up afterwards again, and it'll be as good as new. Your teeth will be as good as new. You say, but dentist, is there anything wrong? Do you need to drill? He says, no, not at all, but I've got time, and you've got time, and come, we can chat a little bit while I drill, as we always do, and we can go, that's it. It would be intolerable, a person wouldn't be able to handle that kind of suffering. But it's the same pain, but it's without purpose. And when pain becomes purposeless, meaningless, that's when it becomes intolerable. So that therefore what we're trying to do in this shiur is to try and understand a little bit about the purpose of suffering, so that we can handle it a little bit more positively. Even the greatest of us have a degree of insecurity resulting from the extent of latitude which the Ribbono Shel Olam has given us. If the Ribbono Shel Olam gave us no latitude and told us precisely what we had to do, then we would be able to handle it without fear. All we would have to do is do it. It's hard enough, but that can be done. But the Ribbono Shel Olam gave us the Torah. What does it mean he gave us the Torah? He gave us the right, the authority, to be creative in our learning, to reach conclusions which perhaps were never reached before, and to find new meanings in the Torah. Now, philosophers do that as well, Lahavdil, but that's not so serious because their philosophies have no relevance to human conduct. So they can come out with new theories and it doesn't really matter. But in Torah, when we come out with a new theory or with a new idea or with a new halacha, it does matter because we have to act in accordance with that. And that makes us a little nervous. You know, there are people like that. There are people that, if you tell them, go and pick some flowers outside for me, they get into a state of nerves. They're obsessive because they don't know which flowers. And if you say, well, go and pick some poppies for me, and they go outside and they find there are red poppies and yellow poppies, they collapse in a state of nerves. What did he mean, poppies? Is he mean the red ones or the yellow ones or both, a mixture? So he comes back and he says, which poppies? And the red and the yellow ones? Say, a bit of both. A bit of both. How much red? How much yellow? There are people who need very precise instructions to feel secure. But the Torah isn't like that. The Torah is given to us with very precise systems of reasoning. That is, we're learning on Friday morning in the Rambam. Those precise systems of reasoning in our generation can reach different conclusions. And there's latitude. We find over and over again that the greatest of our great have been concerned that latitude. For example, we have in the case of Yaakov Avinu. When Yaakov, who's greater than Yaakov, closer to the source than Yaakov, when he is about to meet with Esav, you'll remember, on his return from Lavan, he divides up his camp and he makes preparation for war. And the Torah tells us about him. Vayiro Yaakov ma'oid vayitzer lo. And Yaakov was terribly scared and very worried. This is not some little psychologist saying that Yaakov was scared. This is the Ribbono Shel Olam being made. God himself is giving evidence that Yaakov was scared. Fearful, scared. What are you scared of, Yaakov? Yaakov, the Ribbono Shel Olam has promised you a return safely. When you left Eretz Israel, you had a dream. And God appeared to you in prophecy and said, you're on your way out, don't worry, I will return you to your father's house, etc., etc. You've got a deal. You've got a guarantee. What are you worried about? So Chazal say he was worried, Shema Yigro Machet. Maybe he'd done something wrong, meanwhile, which annulled the guarantee. You know how it is, sometimes you find somebody who's very scared. What are you worried about? I'm worried that somebody can steal all my property. So you say, no problem, there's insurance for that kind of thing. You take out an insurance. Oh, this is a wonderful idea. And he goes to the, takes out the insurance, and you come and you see him a few weeks later, and he's still trembling and nervous. You say, what now? Didn't you take my answer? Didn't you take out insurance? He says, yeah, I took out insurance. But have you ever read the small print, he says? Anything I do, I get fun out of it. If I don't lock up properly, if I don't do any little thing I do that deviates from a very clear and precise system of regulations they've laid down, they can get out of it. So what's the point? Shema Yig, maybe I'll forget something. Maybe I won't do it properly. Says Yaakov, I mean, it's true I have a guarantee, but there's small print in the guarantee. Maybe I've done something wrong. And the Ribbono Shel Olam will no longer stand by that guarantee. That's very difficult to understand, because this is the same Yaakov about whom we learn that he says later on, when he says, when he comes and he gives his message to Esav, this is in Love and Garty. See if I can find it quickly. And Chazal tell us that he says, I have lived with Lovan, the Tariag Mitzvah Shamati, and throughout that time, I have kept all of the 613 mitzvahs. That means Yaakov knows very well that he hasn't sinned. So what is he afraid of? He knows he hasn't transgressed the terms of the guarantee. He says of himself, I've lived with Lovan for 20 years, but the Tariag Mitzvah Shamati, I've kept every aspect of every mitzvah. I've done nothing wrong in all that time. Says the Ibn Ezra. The Yaakov Pochad Shema Chota O Shogag B'machshavtei. Maybe he made an intellectual mistake. What does that mean? See in a moment what it means. You remember there was a spiritualist who was asked by Shaul HaMelech to call up the spirit of Shmuel. Vayomer Shmuel el Shaul, lamo hirgastoni la'alos osi? Why have you made me trembling? Why have you made me so scared to call me up? And the Gemara says about this that Rabbi Elazar used to cry when he learned this pasuk. What was he scared about? Shmuel HaTzadik, Shmuel HaTzadik. Can you imagine anybody on that level? He was afraid of the din, he was afraid that he was being called to justice. Anu alachas kama v'kama, how much more so do we need to be afraid? The Gemara says, how do we know that Shmuel was worried? And the Gemara carries on to say that the spiritualist woman says she saw two people come up when she called Shmuel's spirit up. She saw two come up. Had Shmuel, one was Shmuel, the Ibech, and the other spirit that came up was the Ozal Shmuel, the Asiel Moshe Bahadeh. Shmuel got such a fright when he was called. We don't know how it works over there, but it seems that when a spiritualist, those few odd ones that are genuinely able to do it, when they make contact with a neshama, you can imagine there's a voice goes out, Shmuel Anovi, Shmuel Anovi, you're called to come to such and such a place. And he goes and he hears this voice, he's being called, so he thinks he's being called for din, he's being called for justice. What did he do? He got caught a terrible fright. He went to call Moshe and to say, please, you come with me, I'm being called, you come too. Omale said to him, Dilmechas v'sholem the dinam is behina. Maybe chas v'sholem I'm being called to din because they're claiming that I did something wrong. Kum bahadoi, come with me, Moshe Rabbeinu. And give evidence, deleka milsa b'kasav b'raisa deleki amtio. You give evidence that there is nothing in your Torah which you wrote, which I did not observe. So what's he so scared of? If he knows that he kept everything, what is he so scared of? That he has to ask Moshe Rabbeinu to come and give evidence that he didn't transgress any word of the Torah. And Tosfos asks even more, and Tosfos says, Leiboy lemeima shiyoid lo shikim hakul. He doesn't come necessarily to say that Moshe must give evidence that he observed everything. The mana yoda? For how should Moshe know whether Shmuel observed everything or not? For halo ayobadoira? Moshe and Shmuel were not of the same generation. How can Moshe know what Shmuel observed? So what does Shmuel mean when he says to Moshe, come and give evidence that I observed the entire Torah? What did he say to Moshe? This is how I learnt your Torah. And I acted in accordance with my own conclusions. You come and give evidence that you learnt the same way as I did, that I didn't make a mistake in my learning. That's what I need you for. A lot of wonderful things here, but this explains also Yaakov. It explains this even Ezra. The Yaakov piche pochad shemachota o shogag b'machshavtoi. He was afraid that he learnt incorrectly. And if he learnt incorrectly, then he obviously would have conducted himself in accordance with that learning. He's not afraid, chas v'sholem, that he did anything wrong. He's not afraid that he once gave in to his yetzer hara. He's not afraid that he once knowingly went against the Torah, knowingly or by mistake went against the Torah. Tariag mitzvah shamati, I kept everything. But maybe in my machshav, maybe my thinking wasn't always 100% straight, and therefore the conclusions, the halakhic conclusions I drew, may not be 100% authentic, and I might be, on that basis, I could be blamed, and I wouldn't know. What we see here, interestingly enough, is also the fact that that didn't freeze them into inactivity. They were not obsessive about this. The fear that I can make a decision and be wrong might freeze them into non-creative learning. So don't be mechadish anything. Get hold of a book. Get hold of one of these books that are written, the Kitzur Hilchos this and Kitzur Hilchos that, to tell you how to do this and how to do that, and just do what it says. Finish. Why start learning Gemara and Paskening Halachas? We have the same thing with David HaMelech. A wonderful Gemara with David HaMelech. If I can put my finger on it quickly. David HaMelech says, Lo chosid ani, says the Gemara in Brachos Daf Dalet, Lo chosid ani, aren't I righteous? Shekol malchi mizrach u'mayrav yoshvim agudus hagudus bichvedo. All the kings of the east and the west sit in their clubs. They get together and they discuss things, diplomacy and horses and all sorts of important things. But ani and me, Yodai meluch lochos bedam ubishviru bishilyo. And I sit and my hands are soiled with blood in my efforts to analyze the different types of nido blood, kedei latair isholavat, so as to paskin that a woman may be with her husband, that she's not a nido. That's what I've been doing. A king, a melech Yisrael, is sitting there as a rov. People came to him with shailas. Am I in a state of nido? Am I not? Do I have to separate from my husband or not? And he would sit and he wouldn't just say, no, separate l'chumra. He used to work on it and analyze the blood and dirty his hands with it, physically and metaphorically. Get involved in the details of halacha to come to a decision. Yes, that it's in order. V'lo'ed, not only that. Ela kol ma'ashani v'ise, everything that I do in halacha, ani nimlach b'mefivoshes Rebbe. I consult b'mefivoshes my Rebbe. Because I'm afraid, maybe I'll make a mistake. See, even David HaMelech, we see the same tendency. Yaakov Avinu, Shema Tov Makshavto, maybe he's made an intellectual mistake, maybe he's learnt incorrectly. Shmuel HaNovi, Moshe Rabbeinu, come and give evidence that you learnt it the same as I did. Maybe the Rebbeinu Shlom is going to claim that I learnt incorrectly. David HaMelech, everything I did, and in Nimlach, the Mefivoshes Rebbe, everything I did, I discussed with Mefivoshes, my Rebbe. And I said to him, Mephivoshes Rebbe, Mephivoshes my master, my Rebbe, Yofi Danti, Yofi Chiyavti, Yofi Zachisi, Yofi Tihati, Yofi Timesi. Have I paskened correctly? Was I correct when I judged? Was I correct when I said he was obliged to pay? Was I correct when I said he is not obliged to pay? Was I correct when I said this is kosher and this is not kosher? Or this woman is allowed to be with her husband and this one is not? But note it's in the past tense. Why doesn't he send the shaylat and the pivoshes to start with? Then nowadays, people treat gedolim like post office clocks. If you want to know how many cents to put on the envelope, so you ask the post office clerk, how many cents do I put? It's a little bit too much effort to actually take a manual, to take these things that they print and look and see that if you're sending an ordinary letter, it costs X amount, and to weigh it and see if it costs X or it costs Y. It's easier to ask the post office clerk. You give him the letter and say how many stamps he puts it on, and he tells you. That's it. So you're not responsible. You pay and you go. Now people treat Gedolei Yisrael the same way. If you want to know if it's kosher or trei, if you phone up a Gadol b'Yisrael, you have got to worry a Gadol b'Yisrael. Of whom we've got so few. We've got nothing to worry about but your little shailas. And every little thing has to go to a Gadol b'Yisrael because you're scared to paskin. Because you're scared to take the responsibility of going into it. And as David HaMelech says, dirtying your hands, v'shviru v'shalyo, v'damu v'shviru v'shalyo, dirtying your hands with the details of halacha, feeling it out and working out, is it in order or not, and taking responsibility. Why didn't David HaMelech send the shailas to Mephibosheth? People say today, why should I paskin? They're greater people than me. And it sounds very modest. In fact, greater people than you, yeah, why should I paskin? But it's a chutzpah. Who are you to impose your little shailas on somebody bigger than you? If this is something you can handle yourself, what right do you have to do to go and disturb somebody else? And more important than that, what right do you have to advocate your responsibility of analyzing and of understanding and of paskining? Are you worried? Are you on the right track or not? David HaMelech used to go to Mephibosheth afterwards and say, these are the cases I had. These are the shailas I had this week or this month or this year, however frequently he used to do it. These were the issues. This is how I reasoned and this is the conclusion I came to. Am I thinking straight? Is this in order? V'loi boishti, says David HaMelech, and I wasn't ashamed to do it. But nor was he lazy. Nor did he want Mephibosheth to do his thinking for himself. He didn't use to pass the shaila on. He would paskin it himself. And yet remain worried and remain scared. Maybe I've made a mistake. For that reason there would be constant checking. Constant checking. Constant checking. One of the very, very fascinating, not fascinating, wrong word, awe-inspiring moments of the wonderful opportunity I had to spend some of Rav Moshe Feinstein's last days with him. It was on a particular shaila that we were discussing, which was very heavy and one which comes up here frequently. And I gave him a few examples. And he said, I'll give you the principle. And he gave me the principle and I said, well, for example, there's such and such a case. He said, I'm not prepared to discuss it anymore. If you don't have wide enough shoulders to handle the shaila after I've given you the principle yourself and take responsibility for it yourself, you shouldn't be a rov. I'm not here to answer the details. I've given you the principle. You apply the principle. Yes, once you've applied the principle and you're not sure, has the principle been applied correctly? Have you understood the principle properly? One's entitled to go to one's Rebbe and go through it. But at least you're not using him to do your thinking. At least you've handled the thinking yourself. And in fact, one has to do that. One has to question and query, am I still thinking right? Am I working correctly? Am I analyzing correctly? There's a tremendous difference between a fear and modesty which drives one to constant checking and a fear and modesty which drives one to hiding behind the aprons and the skirts of some Gadol b'Yisrael. That one can't do. That one has to do oneself. And so we find with Yaakov Avinu, with Shmuel Anovin, with countless others, this constant fear. I did the best I could. I reasoned out and I reached my own conclusions in the way you want me to. But maybe I was wrong. Maybe I was wrong. But that doesn't freeze them into inactivity. That doesn't freeze them into uncreativity, to a lack of creativity. They're creative. They analyze. they conclude, they decide, they paskin.
In those days, it was possible to check one's reasoning. Because one's dealing now with deep things, not just with one's reasoning. Yaakov Avinu wasn't worried that he was thinking crooked. Shmuel Anovi wasn't worried that he was thinking crooked. But who knows deep down where there isn't some pneo, maybe some self-interest, some little imperfection in the depths of one's subconscious which cause an incorrect conclusion to be reached. In those days, one had Nevi'im. And the role of the Novi, the role of the prophet, was to reveal hidden depths and to say to a person, you think you're doing right, but deep down, that's not the right thing. The action is in order, but the thoughts, the kavonas, the intentions, not quite right. Only a Novi could do that. We can't do it for ourselves because we're interested parties. We don't know. That's what bothers Yaakov. In Odom Roye Mumbiatsma, a person doesn't see anything wrong with himself. And sometimes, as much as you want to analyze, you're not prepared, you're not able to see that there's an imperfection. An outsider can see, but he can't see into the depths of my heart. So, if an imperfection in action, an outsider can see, and he can be Mekayim, the mitzvah of Echeach, the Chiyat, and he can come to me and he can say, you know what you did? Not quite right. That's not how you were to do it. But if it's something deep in my heart that isn't in my heart that isn't revealed, what outsider can come and tell me? So I have no way of knowing, and an outsider has no way of knowing. How will we ever get right? That was the role of the Novi. The Novi would come along, and through his Nevuah and Ruach HaKodesh, he would say, you know, the actions are all fine. You're going through the right motions. But the Ribbono Shel Olam is not happy with your deep subconscious intentions. There needs to be improvement. And today, Rabbi Avraham Grudzinski says we have, in place of that Nevuah, we have Yisurin. This is where the Ribbono Shel Olam communicates with us in a non-prophetic way. So there are now two ways left. The Ribbono Shel Olam no longer communicates with us in prophecy, certainly not with ordinary people. So there are two ways left for him to communicate with us. He communicates with us intellectually through the Torah. We analyze the Torah. We analyze the Shulchan Aruch, and through that analysis we reach conclusions as to what the Ribbono Shel Olam wants from us in a given situation. That's the one method we use to figure out what does God want of us. And that's a question which we're asking ourselves all the time. In this situation, what does God want of me? If I only knew what He wanted of me, which I would know was correct. Yes, we have a way of figuring out what God wants of us. We have a Gemara, we have Poskim, we have a Shulchan Aruch. We can analyze and figure out intellectually what the Ribbono Shel Olam wants of us. The only problem is, what happens if deep down in us there's an imperfection and there's a self-interest which causes us to understand the halacha incorrectly, and there's no longer prophecy, so we can now no longer use our sources because we might be understanding them just a touch off-center. We no longer have prophets who can come and tell us that we're understanding them a touch off-center. So how do we know? Says Rabbi Avraham Grudzinski, that's where Yisurin comes in. A little suffering. Ribbono Shel Olam sends a message that something needs correction. It's not in order. What you're doing is not right. All of a sudden things start going wrong. And one starts examining, why is it that things are going wrong? What's happening? And through the system of Midah Keneged Midah, where the Ribbono Shel Olam designs the suffering to fit the cause, to make it identifiable. That by analysis we can very often figure out what particular wrong this suffering is coming to correct. There's usually a correlation. It's not random suffering. There's meaning to it. There's purpose to it. And one finds that this particular type of suffering is coming to correct a particular type of incorrection. And the Gemara says, in fact, in Megillah, that Kedoylo Hasorus Tabas, the removal of Haman, of Achashverosh's ring, and the placing it on Moshe, was greater educationally than the 48 prophets and 7 prophetesses which gave Musa to Israel. Because 48 Nevi'im and seven Nevi'os were unable to really have impact on the people. And the mere taking the ring off Achashverosh's finger and putting it on Haman's finger, that transference of power to a virulent anti-Semite, shook the people up and brought them to tshuva in a way that nothing else had done. One saw that in recent history, in the time of the Six-Day War. In Eretz Yisrael, you found hardened atheistic soldiers davening, saying tehillim, putting on tefillin. No rabbonim could get them to do it. No darshonim, no mashgichim, no musar, nobody could get them to do it. A little bit of rumbling of tanks on the border, and that got them to do it. Of course, that wore off afterwards. At that time, the Six-Day War was the first test of Israel's military might. And those who were there at the time might remember that not only was Israel not sure of a victory, Israel was sure of a defeat. The only question was how bad the defeat was going to be. That was the only question. How far were they going to get in? To what extent would they overrun the entire country? Or would there still be places that they could hang on? We forget that. We tend to forget that enormous insecurity, that tremendous fear. That's the power of Yisurin. Rabbonim can talk and Balei Musar can talk. And it doesn't really have that much effect on people. Certainly not on any kind of broad basis. But one little shake-up and look what happens. And in all spheres of life like that, the doctor can say to the patient, you know, watch yourself, you're overweight, you're working too hard, take it easy, it's not healthy, no impact. Give up smoking, no impact. Just a little bit of angina. Ah, what that can do for a person. What that can do for a person. No talking and no doctors and no textbooks can do what one sharp pang of pain in the chest can cause. It's Yisurin. And that really is the meaning of the Gemara when it says in Brachos and Afei, "Amar Rova v'yisaymu Rav Chista, im roye odom sheyisurim bo in olov." If a person sees that punishment is that suffering is coming upon him, yefash besh b'maisa. Before he runs to the doctors and to the psychologists and to the economists, yefash besh b'maisa. Let him figure out. Let him analyze his actions. What am I doing? What's causing it? The cause is not in science. We like to go to a doctor because he will explain to us a cause for which we're not responsible. And that makes us feel better. Or we like to go to a psychologist and he'll say it's the way our parents brought us up. That's why we're doing it. Or we like to go to an economist and he'll say you're losing money because anybody could have done it. It's cycles and this, and who would have known that the market would have fallen? Always reasons beyond our control. And we're prepared to pay a lot to people who will persuade us that our suffering is not our own doing. Great deal. A lot of people make their livings that way. But the Gemara doesn't go for it. The Gemara says you want to figure out what's wrong. If you want to really tackle the suffering at its cause, you fash besh b'maisav. You don't need to go to any psychologist or any economist or any doctor. Lock yourself in a room and sit down and start doing self-analysis. Who am I? What is my potential? What does God want of me? And am I fulfilling it? That's all. Pishpesh v'loy motza. If it should happen that you've done self-analysis and you can find nothing wrong at all, I'm right through every detail. There's nothing you've done wrong. I don't think we even have to read further. That doesn't really apply much to us. But anyway, just for theoretical information, then yitle bevitel Torah. You can assume that the reason is that you haven't used your time well. That there were moments in the day when you could have learned a little bit more, and you didn't. That's the reason that the Yisurim come. And the Gemara goes on. It certainly doesn't apply to us. What do you do? If you find that even that doesn't apply, that there isn't a moment in the day that one is wasted, that we'll discuss in Yitzhak Hashem next week. But as I say, it doesn't really apply practically. But we see the Gemara clearly that the function of Yisurim is lefashbesh b'maisav, to bring a person to self-analysis. But the Lashon of the Gemara is very interesting. The wording is interesting. Im ro'eh odom shi Yisurim bo'olov. It doesn't say im odom sovel Yisurim, if a person suffers pain. It doesn't say that. If a person sees that punishment, suffering is coming upon him, you have to see. You feel, you don't see. Raya means an intellectual analysis. That's part of the problem. We don't see the suffering coming, and so it has to get harsher and harsher and harsher before we start taking notice. We go to a doctor, and he says, not just for a regular checkup, you're feeling as right as rain. And he says to us, no good. You're okay, but you're overweight. You're not living correctly. You're not eating correctly. You're smoking. It's no good. That should already be Yisurin. That should already be considered as suffering. The fact that I'm told such a thing should already cause me despair. It should already cause me to be worried and upset. And if we really did regard that as Yisurin, we would already start correcting ourselves. That would be Roya Odom Shi Yisurim Boyin Olam. The doctor says, look, you're okay now, but in 10 years' time you might have trouble. That's Roya Odom, to be able to see that something one is doing is leading to trouble. And then one feels a little pain, but it's only for a moment. And as one's feeling it for that brief moment, one gets worried and one thinks, oh, that's exactly what the doctor meant. And I'm going to go and see the doctor tomorrow. And a second later, the pain is gone. And it doesn't come back again. Finished. One forgets about it. It's no longer anything to worry about. Im roye odom shi yisurim. That was yisurim. It was pain. For whatever reason, it was pain. And pain means a message from the Ribbono Shel Olam. Pain is information. Pain is direction. It's something. Why should one feel it? Perhaps we should really ask the opposite. Why are we not in constant pain? When you think of how the body is working and everything that's going on inside one, why don't we feel it all happening? There's blood rushing all over the place and all these things working and the heart. We know what happens if we work our muscles a little bit. We go for a long walk, we go for a run. We know what our legs feel like afterwards and how painful we feel and how stiff we feel. There the heart's going day and night, in and out, in and out, in and out. We don't feel a thing. We take it for granted. That's supposed to be normal. It's not normal. Normal would be to feel constant chest pain. It's a miracle that we don't. So when the Ribbono Shel Olam removes the miracle just a little bit and lets you just feel that your things are happening inside you, that's a message. But you need Roya Odom for that. You need perception. You need to notice that that's already a message. Most people don't. Once the pain is gone, the message is over and they forget about it. The Gemara analyzes the reason for the destruction of the first temple. It's also that's national Yisurin, national pain. Why was the temple destroyed? And the Gemara comes to the conclusion, because there was some wrongdoing in the area, on the borders of the areas of the three most important Averis, Gilui Arayis, Shefichas Damim, in the area of sexual immorality, murder, Avodah Zorah. Doesn't mean that people went around serving idolatry and murdering one another, but there was borderline involvement in those three areas. That's why the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. What about the second Beis HaMikdash? They could find nothing that the people were doing wrong at the time of the second destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, at the time of the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. Not even borderline Avodah. There was nothing. All they could find was Sivas Chinuch. Resentment between people, which obviously didn't even express itself in action, because then it wouldn't say they found sin as chinam, then it would say they found aggression, they found theft, they found anger. No, that means it didn't even come to expression. It was an emotion, that's all. There was an incorrect emotion in people, sin as chinam. People were unnecessarily furibled with one another, but they didn't express it, they didn't show it in any way on the surface, sin as chinam. And the Gemara says, which is worse? Was the three Averis worse? Immorality, idolatry, and murder? Or was this deep-seated emotional transgression of unjustified hatred? Which is a worse Averis? And the Gemara says the Beis HaMikdash proves it. The first Beis HaMikdash was in a state of destruction only for a short period of time. Whereas the second Beis HaMikdash yet still hasn't been rebuilt. So the Gemara concludes from that that the Sinas Chinam is worse. Be that as it may, what we see is the power of information, of being able to derive information from the quality of the Yisurim. Not only does the suffering teach us that we have done wrong, but we can judge from the degree of suffering and the quality of the suffering the relative wrongs of different transgressions. So direct is the information that by an analysis of the suffering we can reach an understanding of the chet. Which is a more severe chet? Look at the suffering, which is more severe suffering? Which lasts longer? The example that we have in Rashi, the almond blossoms. We now begin to see that suffering is not a natural state. Or shall we say it is a natural state, but it's not a normal state. It's perfectly natural to suffer, and we should be suffering all the time. But it is the chesed of the Ribbono Shel Olam that has created a normality of not suffering. Normally people don't suffer. When we do suffer, it's a message from the Ribbono Shel Olam. The Ribbono Shel Olam is communicating to us in the most direct way possibly that he wants an improvement from us. That he wants something from us in the future which we weren't giving him in the past. That's what he wants. And that's why we can see the suffering not as an end to an episode, but as the beginning of a new episode. It's not that the Ribbono Shel Olam is punishing us for something that we've done. No, punishment can come later. The Ribbono Shel Olam is pointing out to us because he feels maybe we're not fully aware of the fact. He believes that if we knew about it, we would correct ourselves. He believes that if we were aware that we've made a toz b'machshava, we're thinking incorrectly. We think we're doing right, but we're not. And so he nudges us. And he prods us. And says, Reb Yid, I expect more from you. You're not going straight. This is not the way I want. I want more from you. And that's the power of Yisurim. That's the blossom. When one looks at the Yisurim, one looks at the suffering, and one says, goodness, is that God talking to me? Am I that important to him? That he expects more from me? That he's willing to single me out and to communicate with me? It happens sometimes that a person dies very suddenly. And we tend to comfort the family and say, no, that's also a blessing, which in a way I suppose it is. Didn't suffer. Died very suddenly. If you had to go, people say, if you have to go, it's not a bad way to go, and that kind of thing. That's not really a Jewish attitude. The Jewish attitude is suffering. That means the Ribbono Shel Olam is telling me he wants something from me. And even if it's a suffering which precedes death, even if it's a suffering at the end of life, that can mean the Ribbono Shel Olam is telling me your time is coming. You don't have long to go. Time for tshuva. Time to repair the wrongs. To prepare yourself for Olam HaEmes. It's a wonderful opportunity. That's why we're so opposed to anything but every effort we can to extend a person's life irrespective of the quality of life. For the non-Jew sees the quality of life as a measure of comfort. We see the quality of life as a measure of moral consciousness. And the more a person is in a state of suffering, unfortunately, that's the tragedy of life, the more we're in a state of suffering, the greater is the level of our moral consciousness. We're far more sensitive, far more ethical, far more aware of right and wrong, far more careful when we're a little bit uncomfortable, when we're suffering a little bit. We're much closer to tshuva. And so when we see a person struggling for his life on his deathbed, we don't look at him and say, never shame, let him go, why should he suffer? We say, such quality of life. He's got such opportunity in his state of semi-consciousness even. But the Ribbono Shel Olam is communicating to him, is keeping him alive. That means the Ribbono Shel Olam still feels he has a role to perform. He can still do something with that life. And his suffering might be the very means by which he can achieve that which couldn't be achieved throughout his comfortable life. And you'll have some thoughtless doctor that will come along and turn the machine off. Just when he's reaching the final, he's pulling himself together. for a moment of final tshuva before his last gasp for breath. And the doctor or the nurse comes at that point and turns it off. Is there any greater act of murder than that? To deprive a person of a time in his life which can make his whole life worthwhile? That's why we don't look at it the same way as the non-Jewish world looks at it. We measure quality of life in a completely different way. But when the Ribbono Shel Olam nudges us, we often don't get the message. And we don't get the message because we're still immature. And we like to relate to dramatic messages. We don't understand subtlety. You know, there's a certain greatness. When the Gemara says, Godol Hasoros Tabas, Mimemches Neviim V'Zayin Neviyus, that the removal of that ring was greater than the 48 prophets and the 7 prophetesses. Greater doesn't mean only in its effect. Greater means also in the method. That there is something greater about suffering than about prophecy. And why is it that suffering brings one to greater achievement than prophecy does? Why is it? Prophecy, we've been discussing over the last several weeks, subjects and objects, that in every human relationship at any given time, somebody's a subject, somebody's an object of that relationship. When a prophet comes and tells me that my intentions are not accurate, that my way is not correct, who's the subject, who's the object? The Novi is the Gavri, he's the subject, I'm the Chetza, I'm the object. When a person suffers pain, and he learns this Gemara, Yefashpesh B'maisov, he starts analyzing himself. Who becomes the Gavri? He's becoming the Gavri. He becomes the subject. Who's the object? Also himself. And you remember our shiur a few weeks with Rabbeinu Tam in the Sefer HaYosho, where Rabbeinu Tam said that the soul is the only thing that is capable of being subject and object in the same relationship. You can direct your soul, you can educate your soul, you can communicate with your soul. The soul can communicate with itself, it can educate itself, it can direct itself. Self-analysis offers an opportunity which no other professional relationship can offer. You go to the doctor, he's the subject, you're the object. You go to the psychologist, he's the subject, you're the object. You go to whoever you go to, he's the subject, you're the object. He's telling you. The psychologist tried to get out of it, and the psychiatrist by making the object do all the speaking. So he speaks, but it still doesn't help. At the end of the day, he wants guidance. And who's the guidance meant to come from? From the doctor. Godol Hasoros Tabas is something special about the self-knowledge that results from suffering as opposed to the self-knowledge that results from prophecy. When a prophet comes and tells me you're not doing it correctly, your thoughts are not pure, your intentions are not straight, I hear it. The same as I hear when the doctor tells me you're not eating properly and you're overweight. The same as I hear it when the traffic department tells me not to overtake on a white line because it's dangerous. I hear it. Does it really affect me? No, that's somebody outside talking at me. The only time I get affected is when I act. My own maisim, my own actions affect me, not somebody else's actions. Nobody else can really affect me. If I act within myself, then I can affect myself. And Gedola Asoras Tabas, when it comes to Yisurim, Yefashpesh B'maisov, you've got to do it yourself. There's no prophet, there's no Novi that can tell you what's going on. You have to be your own psychiatrist. You have to be your own analyst. You have to sit down with yourself and analyze yourself and reach your own conclusions. When you've decided that you're not eating correctly, when you've decided you're overweight, when you've decided you've got to give up smoking, then you will do it. So it is here. And people stop listening to the Nevi'im because they weren't sensitive enough. Ribbono Shel Olam shifted the method to self-analysis, to Mefashpesh B'maisov. Now analyze yourself. All I'll do is make you analyze yourself. I'll bring the environment which lends a conduciveness to analyzing yourself. I'll bring a little suffering. And you'll start asking why. And once you start asking why, you're on the track to self-analysis. Mefashpesh B'maisov, analyze yourself. And once you're the doctor and you're the patient, you'll find the results far better. Patient compliance is much better when you're the doctor. because you regard yourself with much greater esteem than you regard anybody else. You regard your knowledge of yourself with much greater esteem, and you're prepared to listen to yourself much more clearly than you're prepared to listen to somebody else. We'll listen to a doctor if he removes responsibility from ourselves. We'll go to a psychiatrist if he tells us it's not your fault, it's the way you were raised or educated. And the doctor tells us it's not your fault, genetic. Then we love our doctors and we love our psychiatrists and we believe in them implicitly. But when the doctor tells us it is your fault and you need to alter your behavior and your lifestyle, and then we seek a second opinion. It's not so simple to believe him then. And he's not the only authority, and there are other people who hold differently, and all of a sudden we become big experts. And it's a matter of our own responsibility, says the Gemara Yefashbet Maisav, you're the only authority, and you've got to reach your own conclusions. But the problem is that we still like messages, we still like to hear from outside, and the Ribbono Shel Olam still has to bring Yisurim. But the Ribbono Shel Olam likes to bring delicate Yisurim. Subtle Yisurim. That's all that's needed. Subtle pain, the Gemara says that if you put your hand into your pocket to take a 5-cent piece out for the parking meter in the days when parking meters still used to take 5-cent pieces, that was the time of the Gemara, you see, and you put your hand in your pocket and by mistake you pull out a 50 cent piece, and in the days of the Gemara, a long time ago, no parking meter would accept a 50 cent piece. And you take out a 50 cent piece and by mistake, that's Yisurim. Because it means you've got to go and put your hand back in your pocket. You should ask yourself, why? Why didn't I get the right one out? Why is God doing this to me? And it's a miracle. Either way it's a miracle, but if there's Hashkocha, why is it that I put my hand into my pocket? I know there's a 5-cent piece there. I don't need any miracles. I just need to get the 5-cent piece in my fingers. Why does the Ribbono Shel Olam calls me such agmas nefesh that I'm now going to put my hand back into my pocket? And if we would stop there and query, no further Yisurim would be necessary. If we would say, Fashpesh for myself, that means God is telling me that He regards my time as not as valuable. Doesn't make any difference. Stick your hand back in your pocket, miss another robot. We should ask ourselves, driving along the road, missing every traffic light. Why? What have I done wrong today? It's crazy, missing traffic. I never miss one single traffic light. I'm a tzaddik after all. Why are all the traffic lights red today? Must be that the Ribbono Shel Olam says, you obviously have plenty of time today. I must have given the Ribbono Shel Olam reason to believe that I'm not short of time today. Where's the Bittul Torah been today? Where have I been wasting time? What's been happening? The moment you reach those conclusions, the robots start changing. They become green again and life goes on as normal again. It's not necessary to bring any greater Yisurim than that. It's really so. It's not that. It really is so. But we don't notice that that's a message. We think that's normal. The Gemara says, there's a delightful Gemara in the Dorim where the Gemara says, Godul Nes, in the Dorim of Memalev, Godul Nes Shemase L'Chile, Yose Min HaNes Shemase L'Chananya Mishol V'Azarya. Imagine today, Chananya, Mishol, and Azarya, three people would walk into a furnace and sit and have a cup of coffee there and come out and tell the story. Imagine what an effect that would have on people. Miracles. Such a nice. Throw a piece of paper into it, it burns up. You throw a piece of steel into it, it melts in 2 minutes. And there a few tzaddikim sat, had a cup of coffee in the furnace and came out again. And you say to them, why? Well, it was cold outside. They wanted to sit in the furnace, a little bit warmer. Didn't you burn up? No. Why should we burn up? It would be the most amazing, dramatic story on the front pages of every newspaper. But says the Gemara, when a person has flu and he gets better afterwards, that's a much greater miracle. Why don't we regard it as such? Why is it a greater miracle? Because Shel Chananya Mishol V'Azarya Eish Shel Hedyot. What is that furnace? It's a fire. Who made the fire? A human being. V'Hakol Yecholim Mechabeisa. Anybody can turn the fire off. It's no big deal. But who made the flu? The Ribbono Shel Olam. What chance is there through normal means of getting rid of the flu? People used to die from flu, they don't anymore. Isn't that a miracle? Isn't that a mess? But we don't regard it as such because we like drama. And the more dramatic it is, the more we're prepared to accept the message. because subtlety needs us to be gavra. Subtlety needs us to do the thinking. And we're not willing to think. We want somebody else to do the thinking. And so, okay, if there are no Nevi'im today, no prophets, we want the kind of miracle which talks to us so directly that it shouts at us. It screams at us. We're not prepared to listen to a whisper in the voice. Rebuke, little whisper. You know, what you're doing is not quite right. A little bit of improvement. Use your time a bit better. Watch what you say. Careful how you treat people, and you'll find life will treat you much better. A little whisper we don't hear. We need to be shaken up with drama. Then we're prepared to listen a little bit. And that's another reason why the blossom is used as the symbol of Puranus. Just a blossom. That's already the stage at which we need to look and admire and respond and think and take this kind of funny pleasure in the Yisurim, just as one takes in the blossom. The blossoms are here. That means summer's coming. That means there's a future. That means the world is warming up again. Wonderful thing. You know, here it's almost pathetic. We don't appreciate spring. The reason we don't appreciate spring is because we don't have a winter. Even after the few days that we've had, yeah, that's not winter. But when you have a winter, a Russian winter, a European winter, a North American winter, when you have temperatures of minus 20 degrees, minus 25 degrees centigrade, when you have situations where you've got anybody's been overseas in the winter knows what it's like, where you can't walk, where you've got to walk every couple of minutes, you've got to run into a building just to warm up again, where you've got frosticles on your face, where you can come into a situation, you can have, my father tells me his first winter in yeshiva, he was walking outside and he came inside, they just said to him, don't touch your nose. And he didn't know, he comes from South Africa, what would he know about these things? If you touch your nose, will fall off. It's so brittle, it's completely frozen. We don't know what that cold is like. And months and months and months of it. You don't see the sun, you don't see the sky. Heavy clouds, snow, freezing. And then gets a little less freezing. And you see the almond blossoms. You know what a thrill that is. Things are coming right again. Things are going to warm up again. We don't have that thrill. We take the blossoms for granted. The blossom is the first indication, and that's what Puranas are meant to be. That's the only suffering that is meant to be in the world. Just the light, pale-colored suffering of the almond blossom. That's all you need. Because if you respond to that, nothing more needs to happen. It's only because we don't respond to that that the Ribbono Shel Olam needs to tighten the screws more and more and more and more until the suffering becomes so coarse and so heavy and so dramatic. Finally, we're forced into some kind of response. Growth and suffering. There are many other aspects to suffering, some of which in Yetzer Hashem we'll still discuss next week. But at least this, to realize that suffering is not a punishment. If the Ribbono Shel Olam wanted to punish us, he would kill us. That's the only punishment that really fits the kind of crimes we commit every day of our lives. Lack of gratitude, lack of acknowledgement, all the little things that we do, so many of them. If the Ribbono Shel Olam wanted to punish us, he should terminate our lives immediately. The fact that he doesn't means he's not punishing us. That's not punishment yet. So what's the suffering? The suffering is communication. The suffering is the almond blossom. The suffering is an indication that God wants more from us in the future. The suffering is that the Ribbono Shel Olam is not satisfied with what we've done and he wants better. The suffering is a sign of optimism, a sign that there's still life, a sign that there's quality of life, a sign that there's something to live for and something to live up to.